Thank you, Walter. And, you know, this was really a landmark day for Walter. Yesterday, he took the history test for citizenship. He was able to say how many stripes were in the flag. He was able to say the term duration of a U.S. president. And we have a couple of good sentences in English. So this is, he's doing very well, and we need to congratulate Walter on that. Although apparently he did call for the presidency term to be a little shorter than what it is, apparently. Well, thank you for being here so early in the morning, frankly, with this prime time that we got for our symposium. I wasn't expecting anyone other than a few of the people in the symposium to be here, but thanks for your attendance. My title is modified a little bit from what was in the book. I'm really not going to talk all about all kinds of different mosquito diapause, it's just that in Culex pipiens. And we're rather new to this field, just have been working with mosquito diapause rather recently, so what I'll do today is first give a little background of some of what we know have known for quite some time about Culex diapause, and then talk about some of the more molecular sorts of questions we're asking in this field after that. First, the players in this, these are the people who did the work while I watched, and starting in the first two people to be involved in my lab are Joe Reinhardt and Rebecca Robish, who have now moved on to greener pastures. The current people on this project in my lab involve Rob Michaud, who's done some of the metabolomics work I'll talk about, Josh Benoit, who's working on some of the desiccation responses in Culex pipiens, Mijong Kim, who's working some of the cytoskeletal changes. They're both here in the audience today. Chao-Ho Sim is working on some of the insulin signaling work that I'll talk about at the end of the talk. So, as many of you probably know, those of you who work with mosquitoes for a lot longer than I have, there are two subspecies, Pipiens pipiens and Pipiens quinquefasciatus. It's really only this subspecies, a northern house mosquito, that has the capacity for diapause, entering it in response to short day. This southern one appears to not have that that response. And say where I live in Ohio, it's Pipiens pipiens, but further south into Kentucky, it's the other subspecies. This is the subspecies that is being, the genome is being worked on. This is indeed an adult diapause that Culex pipiens enters. However, the photosensitivity for determining this diapause begins late in the final larval instar and during the early pupal stage in this case. This is a short day induced diapause. This is some old data for Bruce Eldridge. In fact, it's kind of plotted in a way that we normally don't plot these sorts of things. It's sort of the reverse. He's plotting non-diapausing females, and this is short day to long day. We usually think of this in terms of critical photoperiod curve that plots the diapause incidence instead of the non-diapause incidence, but from this you can readily see that at the shorter day lengths you're getting fewer non-diapausers, therefore more diapausers, and you can see that level of diapause actually increases as you go down with lower temperatures. I must say this is a little stranger than most than many photoperiodic response curves, because it seems to be spread over quite a bit of time in terms of the photosensitivity. In many cases, these critical photoperiod curves are very sharp. They drop off, you know, maybe within 15 minutes of whatever. But this one seems to be spread out a bit more, according to Bruce's data. The adults hang out in culverts like this, in caves, in basements. This is Rebecca Robish coming out of one of the culverts in Columbus, and I try to select graduate students who are small enough to fit into these sorts of places, and Josh doesn't quite fit, but the others do. So that's the sort of place that they spend the winter. The diapause is characterized by arrested development of the ovaries. You see here follicle length projected here. Those after adult emergence, if you've been programmed for long day length, the follicles grow rather rapidly. Those reared under short day length, follicles remain small. But with time, this is a week scale here, this is days here, you see that this diapause is, again, a little different than some, in that the follicle length does, there's sort of progressive growth throughout that time when they are in diapause. So after, 20, 22 weeks, they attain this same length. It's just, it's just a slow progressive thing that takes them 20 weeks to achieve what a non-diapauser does in 3 days. The other feature of this diapause is very clear cessation in blood feeding. This shows response to the host from some of Neff Bowen's work. Response to the host, you see the non-diapausers readily taking a blood meal. Diapausing ones really don't take blood meals. They very rarely, in fact, I'm surprised she saw this much blood feeding. We certainly don't see it in ours, but they will indeed take a blood meal if they're sort of forced into it. If you really, put your, put a source there and don't give them too many other options, they will indeed do it. But a blood meal taken like that is not utilized. Any force-fed blood is ejected. It's certainly not used for lipogenesis, and it is not used to initiate villagenesis. So even if you get the blood into them, they're not going to use it. Instead, they focus on sugar feeding at that time, and they accumulate about twice the amount of lipid reserves that you see in a non-diapausing or a pre-diapausing or non-diapausing individual. So dramatic shift, no more blood feeding, and you focus on sugar feeding. This diapause, adult diapause, like most adult diapauses, is JH regulated. Some results from Radio et al. Showing again, days after emergence, the JH titer increases rapidly in a non-diapausing animal within the first day or so, whereas in the non-diapausing animal, JH titer remains low. And the result is seems to be directing all these, no blood feeding, no host seeking growth of follicles. Okay, this starts some of our data looking at, in this case, just the tolerance of a of the diapause comparing to non-diapausing animals, demonstrating that this is exposure time to minus 5 degrees and percent survival. Non-diapausing individuals rear to 25 degrees don't handle minus five very well at all. They die very quickly within about 12 hours. Rearing those non-diapause, that is long-day programmed animals, at 18 degrees, lowering the temperature of rearing, does increase their cold hardiness, but not nearly as much as if those diapausing animals, as you see in diapausing animals that have been reared also at 18 degrees, but at short day length. So definitely there's an enhancement of cold tolerance that goes along with the diapause program, and also an increased resistance to desiccation that's shown here. This is again, a panel from one of Joe and Rebecca's papers showing a whole bunch of different relative humidities, and again, we're looking at days of exposure and survival. And really, the only point I want to make here is in each of these cases, the right-end curve is the diapausing ones reared at 18 degrees, and they're consistently able to survive in a drier environment for much longer. Some of Josh Benoit's data looking at what might be behind this. Josh measured the carbohydrate content of the cuticle, and the non-diapausing ones, and also reared at either 18 or 25 degrees, that's sort of this level of hydrocarbons on their surface. If you reared under short day in the diapause, they have about twice that level of hydrocarbon on their cuticle. What surprised me a little bit is if you take them out here at 40 days and then switch them back to 25 degrees, they start losing that hydrocarbon. I think I would have assumed they would have probably maintained that once they had it, but they do seem to lose it if you switch them to another temperature. It's also quite apparent that there's a great economy in terms of utilization of your lipids. This shows proportion reduction of lipids, again, some of Josh's data, days after onset of starvation here. You see at 25 degrees, non-diapausing animals, the curve looks like this. Rearing them at 18 degrees, they don't lose their lipids quite as rapidly, but they're still losing it pretty rapidly. Whereas these diapausing ones are just, a great economy of lipid utilization, that's certainly one of the keys to being able to survivor, these sorts of long durations that diapause involves. This is some metabolomic data from Rob Michaud, just in this case trying to characterize different metabolic events that are occurring during diapause. So this is simply a matter of going in and measuring everything you can measure, and what we see here are percentage changes, in this case increases, decreases here. He was able to record 59 different metabolites. Of those, 34 of them were changing, and this is a reflection of how that animal at 7 days after eclosion compared, if you're in diapause, compared to one that was not in diapause. You see there are indeed a number of compounds here that are highly upregulated, up to 300% increase, a number of ones that go down quite a bit. I'm not going to go into details here, just to really the idea that, hey, there are a lot of major differences metabolically going on. Especially a great increase, I don't expect you to read these labels from where you are, but a great increase in the number of the things associated, the sugar-related things. This is trehalose here, really a high amount of trehalose. It's also kind of interesting that sorbitol and erythritol, things that are polyols that are often used as cryoprotectants, appear not to be used in this species. We saw no evidence of any of the classic cryoprotectants going up, and we think that they're probably relying very heavily on trehalose as a cryoprotectant, and trehalose works very well as a cryoprotectant as well. Okay, we're interested in trying to see we've seen a lot of sort of phenotypic differences between a diapause and non-diapausing animal. So what kinds of differences are occurring at the molecular level? What differences are operating there? So this is the work spearheaded by Rebecca Robish and Joe Reinhardt, using SSH to pull up genes that might be differentially expressed, and then evaluating those clones using northern blots, and then trying to identify what we're doing. So our sort of standard situation here is we use 28S as a control, but we have lanes for non-diapause, early diapause, both at the same age, and then a late diapause strain. So two diapausers and one non-diapause. So that's what the format all of those will be in. So the number of genes that were upregulated in early diapause, suddenly upregulated in late diapause. And frankly, I was a little surprised that there weren't really found two that were upregulated throughout the whole diapause period. I think I would have anticipated there might have been more of that sort. So let me just quickly talk about some of the types of genes that were involved here. There were a number involved in regulatory functions, food utilization, stress responses, and so on. And I'll talk, just give a few examples of several of these next. Under the regulatory genes, we've listed S3A, RPS6, and RPS24. These are genes that are pretty well known to be involved in regulation of oogenesis, and indeed we see that in early diapause, these genes are not being expressed, whereas in late diapause, as you approach the end of diapause, these genes turn on. So we suspect that shutting down some of these ribosomal genes is really quite important for bringing about that developmental arrest. And actually, this RPS6 has also been involved in implicating some other modes of developmental arrest, and we're particularly looking at that, and actually Majone's going after these genes in a little more detail currently. Well, as we implied earlier, there is this switch from blood feeding. You no longer blood feed, and you switch to sugar feeding when you go into diapause. So, well, the non-diapausing ones take the blood meal, but they also are sugar feeders as well. But the diapausing ones are exclusively sugar feeders. They feed on nothing but sugar normally. And this is reflected in a number of interesting gene changes that are pretty apparent and make quite a bit of sense. Indeed, those that are involved in the trypsin serine protease, these two genes here you see are expressed only in the non-diapausing animals. They're shut down in early diapause, and you see it coming up a little bit in late diapause. But this, these are the genes that are involved in digesting the blood meal. They clearly shut off, as in all these cases, none of these have been blood fed or offered a blood meal, but strictly by you know, rearing this one under long day conditions, it expresses those genes to handle the blood meal, whereas short day rearing does not express those genes. Conversely, we see this upregulated gene here in early diapause that is fatty acid synthase. So this is, you know, kind of an interesting switch where you shut down protein utilization and instead bring up the genes that are involved in converting those sugars into lipid resources, lipid reserves. There are a number of interesting cytoskeletal changes that are occurring. Just one that we'll cite here is a muscle-specific actin that seems to be coming on in relation to diapause. Some of Jung Kim's data, too, looking at the actual midgut, and you see this is a non-diapausing midgut looking at actin, and you see a great increase in the polymerization of actin in that midgut in the diapausing animal. None of the other, we don't see these sorts of dramatic changes in any of the other tissues we've looked at, but the midgut is making some pretty interesting changes, again, just in response to the diapause program, and you can actually enhance it a bit more with low temperature. It's kind of weird, but we certainly didn't expect to see transposable elements showing up in this regard. And I really, if anyone can tell me what this means, I'd like to know. But both the late diapausers, we have a couple transposons that seem to be upregulated. And, you know, I wouldn't think so much about it if this was just the only case where that happens. But also, we do a lot of work in our lab with sarcophagus, which has a pupil diapause. And we have a transposable element that's more highly expressed in that diapause as well. And there's a report from Bombyx Mori in its diapausers. Transposable element that's there, and I really hope someone takes me aside later and tells me what that means. Okay, well, those were genes we talked about before, ones that came up in SSH. The other approach we're pursuing is to think about genes that we think might be interesting in this regard and go after some of those. And in that regard, we're quite interested in exploring the possibility of insulin signaling being involved in this process. And the main rationale for that comes from some really nice work with C. elegans, where this dower formation have a number of these DAF, things are known as the DAF genes, have been characterized and implicated in the regulation of dower formation in C. elegans. So essentially the pathway looks like this, insulin receptor here, porkhead transcription factor, also known as FOXO or DAF16, is a really critical gene in this, and you either go this way or, well, there's a lot of unknown genes here, but the end result is a dower larva that is much like a diapausing animal, extended longevity and reduced fecundity. So with that sort of background information, we went after these DAF equivalents in Culex, and a couple that we've cloned are here, the insulin receptor, DAF2, and focus especially on this other one, the forkhead transcription factor, FOXO, which is the DAF16 equivalent. That shows their identity compared to Gambi or Aedes aegypti. So we've been... RNAi has worked pretty well in this system for us. Essentially, we're taking double-stranded RNAi, double RNA, injecting it one day after occlusion, and then do assays 4 days later or 8 days later and look for either changes in the lipid accumulation and life cycle and also follicle changes and those sorts of things. When we look at the lipid assay, this is DAF16 or FOXO, measuring here total lipid content. You see the RNAi indeed works to knock these down. Again, DAF16 is FOXO, forkhead transcription factor. 4 days after adult occlusion, there's really not, you know, too much happening yet at that point. The controls, now in this case, we're injecting it into the, you know, diapause destined adult that's going to the diapause, the ones that, you know, accumulate twice the amount of lipid. And here you say day 8 to control is stashed away quite a bit of lipid. when we've knocked down FOXO, it goes down. Yes. Oh, time away. Well, okay. 5 minutes. Okay. Gotcha. When you knock down FOXO and deplete that lipid reserve, you also don't live as long. And the other gene we're playing with is the insulin receptor. And here, looking at the primary follicle size for the now we're looking at non-diaposing animals. The expression of the insulin receptor here, and this is these are both controls, Degal control. The normal diapause situation is over here when we've knocked down that insulin receptor in the non-diapause. It goes from here down to here. So we're definitely getting a retardation in follicle growth that looks very similar to diapause. As I alluded to earlier, JH is known to regulate this diapause, and you can break the diapause with that. And indeed, this shows a sort of dose response here. If you knock down the insulin receptor, as we've done here, and then add JH to it in a dose-dependent fashion, you get an increase in follicle growth. So certainly suggesting that this insulin signaling pathway, when it's shut down, that effect can be reversed by the application of JH. So our idea is, or the models we developed here, is insulin acting on insulin receptors, stimulating JH synthesis, resulting in ovarian development, and normally this would result in an inhibition of FOXO, so you don't get the fat accumulation. And by contrast, in a diaposing animal, insulin being shut down, the insulin receptor not as active or as present, preventing the synthesis of juvenile hormone, which in turn releases the inhibition on FOXO, leading to fat hypertrophy and the other attributes of diapause. Well, just one little bit of information. I don't have data shown here because it's very recent. Although there's only one insulin receptor, there appear to be about seven insulins in Kinexpipiens, and we have now have all of those as well. And indeed, for the ones that we've gone through so far, at least, it does indeed look like the amount of insulin itself of that gene coding those insulins is lower indeed in the diaposing animal. So it's consistent with that, but we still have to work out some of the details on that. Just in summary, I think we've looked here. Diapause enhances stress tolerance, elicits a shift in metabolism, and we've pointed out a number of different diapause-regulated genes that are involved with food utilization, stress responses, cytoskeletal modifications, reproductive switches. And we're convinced that insulin signaling is involved in this process, and we think we're on track for showing that GH reverses that shutdown in insulin signaling. And I think that is my last slide, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, it is. So, do I allow any time for questions? Okay. So. Yes, George. I'm sorry, have we worked with the quink hybrids? No, we haven't. And I don't think, at least Woody Foster assures me that the quink hybrids wouldn't get up as far as Columbus, so we don't think.
I did not assure you of that.
You did not assure me of that. Yes, you did, Woody. Sorry, I was hoping he wouldn't be in the room, but he is. Well, at any rate, they go into diapause, and yeah, I mean, I suppose there's the possibility there might be some there, but I don't think so. But I wish the Genome Project would be on Pipiens instead of the Quinks, but we're still hoping to utilize that Genome Project. Yeah. Duff.
Is the trypsin transcript that you showed, is this the early trypsin, the late trypsin, or the
other trypsin? Yeah, no, I think it's, I think it's an early trypsin, but I'm not, I'd have to go back and look at our stuff again. I forget. I know we asked that question one point, I just don't remember the answer. Judy.
Well, Dave, if you have something to keep your record, you're informed with the doc.
Yeah.
And then you have your sugar, you're coming down.
No. That's Justin. No, I'm not quite sure what that means. I think there's a difference between thinking of maybe the immediate response of feeding on sugar, but then a couple days later, using that information to shut down the pathway for diapause. But no, I don't know. I think it's a temporal thing, though, and hey, I don't know.